My name's Keith Robinson. I'm president of Intellivision Productions, and your panel on Intellivision today, let's starting from the end, is Mr. Mike Minkoff, the programmer of PBA Bowling and Snafu. And next to him is Ray Kessner, the programmer of Burger Time.
Yay.
Everybody loves Burger Time. Peter Kaminsky did Frog Bog. John Soule, Astro Smash, and B-17 Bomber. Karen Nugent did the graphics for Burger Time and for many other games. Bill Fisher, who did Space Hawk and Space Spartans and B-17 Bomber with John and with Steve. Stephen Roney, who did Space Spartans, B-17 Bomber, did the
Aquarius
version of Utopia. How many people have that? Yay!
All right.
We got some real collectors out here.
And I'll bet none of them have Masters of the Universe for ColecoVision.
No, none of them do.
Oh.
What's that? Well,
get us the license.
Well,
you can't even release it from television yet.
I did. Tron Solar Sailor. Joe King, who did the graphics for many games, but also did the co-design of Hover Force.
Yes!
Which will get as much applause as Michelle Mock for Off the Wall, a game that I think the title screen was designed on. That was it. And Dave Warhol, who did Thunder Castle with Connie Goldman, also did Mind Strike, and then produced all of the games that INTV Corporation released. All the Super Pro sports games and all of the other good stuff there.
About 25 games.
All right. I thought what we'd do is people have asked in the past, what was it like to work on television? And we realized we were talking last night that we have people arrange here chronologically, approximately, when they came into working on Intellivision. And it's really, even though it's a very short period of time, it's a completely different experience. Different offices, we moved around so much, different equipment that was available, different tools and everything. So I think that what we really need to do is go down and kind of break it up into the groups of when they started and get the experience, what the experience was like for these different groups. And starting at the end there, Mike and Ray worked at Mattel on the handheld games before the Intellivision, taking back to, that was probably about 1976?
79 when I transferred in.
Oh, 79? Okay.
They had started working on video games a couple years earlier, the handhelds.
But you were programming on the handheld games, right?
Yeah.
And so what was that like? What type of systems were you working on? What kind of group was it?
Well, we actually had two groups, one that did simulation coding and one that did production coding. I was in the simulation coding group.
And I was in the production coding group.
Hey!
what does that mean? What's
you wanted to... Okay, the handheld games were done like on a 4-bit microprocessor, an old calculator type chip. So you really couldn't experiment with it. So we normally did simulation either on a data widget that had like a 6502, or like in the case of the game I worked on with Ray, I did simulation on an Apple II.
Right. So what initially happened was that Rockwell had all these calculator chips. They came online with a lot of capacity, and they came to Mattel and said, "Hey, we got all this capacity. We got nothing to do. Can we work together with you guys to do some games?" And so Rockwell actually designed the initial set of games for us. And then about 1978 or so, they said, "Let's bring a lot of this stuff in house. We're paying lots of money to Rockwell. We could probably do a cheaper job inside." And so they started. That's when they really started the electronics division. When I hired onto electronics, there was about 30 people. And Mike joined electronics. Mike had been at Mattel forever.
10 years.
10 years forever. Yeah. and so by the time you joined, it was probably 60 to 100 people by then.
Mid 79 was when I joined.
Yeah.
At electronics.
Now,
what was the thing about the gin game? What was the big controversy on that?
Okay, the gin game. My first game at Mattel was called Computer Gin. The guy who did the simulation said, "Well, you can't do a real gin game." And we had, it was a 4-bit processor. We had 2K of instructions to write a gin game. He said, "You can't do a real gin game in 2K of instructions. So let's kind of fake it out and let's cheat." And So we came up with this game. It cheated. It was you know, if you didn't pay much attention to it, it was decent, but it was kind of dorky. And so when Mike joined, he said, "You can't do a game like this."
Yeah, I happen to like playing gin, and I joined the electronics group. I've been in the toy company for 10 years. I joined the electronics group, and the guy that done the simulation on this was kind of showing me around and whatever, and I was assigned to work on developing a simulation for soccer too, and so I wanted to play his gym game, and he'd simulated it on the Apple II, and you know, I would play with it, and it was like, what I found out was the secret behind the first version of Computer Gin. Am I allowed to tell this?
Absolutely. It's not a closely guarded secret.
Oh,
you can find it on the web.
I think your NDA's expired, Mike.
So the secret of the original Computer Gin was the computer deals a gin hand.
To itself.
That's fairly easy to do. And then depending on the level of difficulty that you've selected, it throws away one, two or three cards,
right.
And then its entire logic is waiting and seeing if those cards come up, and if they do, then it keeps them. And when it's got 10 cards, it's gin hand. It goes gin, but it could make a gin hand and not know it with other cards. And I thought, wait a minute, and it didn't allow you to knock. And you know, this guy, neither of us could remember his name right now,
yeah.
But he said, no, you can't do that. Oh, come on. So I took the Apple II home for a weekend and played around with it and came up with this routine. Came in Monday morning and said, look, play this. Play the gin. So everybody was quite excited. Hey, this is a real gin game. They'd originally done gin one, had what, three games in it?
Three games. It had Go Fish. It was like blackjack, but it wasn't blackjack. We kind of cheated on that one too. And I can't remember all the details of that. It was a weird game, and then we had this gin game, and so we basically threw away the Go Fish. We threw away the blackjack game that wasn't really blackjack, and we just said, we're going to do gin, and we're going to do it right. But Mattel was so embarrassed about this cheating gin game that they said, well, we just won't tell anybody about the cheating gin game. We'll just kind of slip the real one into production and nobody will notice. And so, however, the sales on the original gin game were so bad that, you know, I think we made about 100 ROMs or 100 versions of it. You know, I think I ended up with about 20 of them.
You got 20? I only got one.
Well, I got the chips. So what you do is you get the chips and then you unsolder the sockets where the chips are and then you solder in the new ones. And so it's real easy, but oh yeah, I have to add a speaker because we added sound to it too, I think. So anyway,
but so it never actually reached production. The Gen 2.
No, there's maybe
just the chips you have at home. Just,
well, I don't have any more chips.
Oh, you used them all up.
I have a few units left, and I've distributed them to people at my wedding and stuff like that.
Gee, I'd like to have one.
Yeah.
Anyway, so while the handhelds are being done at Mattel, an outside consulting firm from Mattel, APH, in Pasadena, is working on the Intellivision console to fight with the Atari 2600. So, Peter, you actually worked for APH. Now, what was that environment like, and what type of tools did you have in working on them?
Interestingly enough, I had really didn't realize that there was a whole crew of people working at Mattel doing any of that stuff. So, the crew there was a bunch of programmers from Caltech, and I actually started as a summer job, and what they would do is every summer they'd pick 10 or so undergraduates from Caltech, and it was kind of a dream job. I'd been wanting to do video games since I played Galaxian in 77, 78. They'd bring us in, and we'd get to do a little game, whatever we wanted to, for the first 2 weeks. Build one to throw away, basically, was the idea. And then they'd put us on a real project. So the real project I got put on after my first little bomb game, flying over and dropping bombs, was Frog Bog. It was a lot of fun. It was basically 20 or so engineers from Caltech. It was a lot like a computer lab. We worked on PDP-10s, which were kind of descendants of mini computers. They seemed like microcomputers at the time. Now they'd be little toys. But we had it was pretty fancy stuff at the time. The crew there were all geeks. We built our own assemblers, built our own pixel editor. We had this really cool pixel editor with a bunch of buttons, like 30 buttons across and 30 buttons down that would light up, and you design graphics that way. The PDB-10s, they had a hard drive, actually, back in those days, which was amazing, but the hard drives were removable platters about this big, literally. Probably held a couple megabytes. It was a lot of fun. We just had a blast doing programming stuff, and the folks that ran it really understood engineers. They were engineers themselves, so once in a while we'd have a tussle with Mattel marketing, but that was basically handled by the folks managing stuff, and we'd get switched from one project to another.
So every now and then somebody from Mattel would wander through and look at things, and
yeah, we never really understood why these people were wandering around in our little lab.
But Ray, what was it like when you saw the first Intellivision?
It was very cool, of course. Intellivision was another thing that it's all the engineering was done for that. The software was done at APH. We bought the system from Magnavox, right? So all that stuff was done. I think
General Instruments was.
Huh?
It was General Instruments was the.
Right, General Instruments, but the CPU, but Magnavox.
Oh, that's right, Magnavox. Yes,
Magnavox,
that's right.
Did the engineers, and so we hired a couple of Magnavox engineers that were working in our office. So we were kind of one day. These boxes showed up with Intellivisions in them. And so, you know, they unwrapped them, hooked them up to a TV, and started playing them. And the first game that I saw was baseball. And they were playing baseball, and we were watching it. And I still remember just the exhilarating feeling everybody had when they heard, "You're out." You know, so cool. And, you know, as time went on, we got more and more units. The real privilege was, well, can I take one home to show my family?
Ah.
And so, you know, if you were blessed, well, you could take one home and you know, oh, look at this. And I was working with a high school group at church, you know, during that time. And so I would bring one home and invite the high school group over. And they were like, whoa, this is cool. So we had a great time.
Now, Mike, you were one of the first people from Mattel that was chosen. This goes back to a comment that Ray, I think you made earlier, which I think is a kind of a watchword, or I think it's actually in part of the motto of Mattel: we can do it cheaper if we can bring it in house.
Yeah,
I think you said about the handhelds. And so, Mike, you were one of the first ones chosen from the Mattel group to go out to APH and train to learn how to program this. So, what was it like going out and meeting the APH guys?
So, after doing a couple of different handhelds, Soccer 2 and Lookalive Football, myself and another programmer, Rick Levine, who had done a handheld bowling game, were assigned to go to APH to learn about Intellivision and to bring the technology back in-house. And so basically, you know, Mattel was located in Hawthorne, APH was in Pasadena, so we, like 3-4 days a week, we'd be in Pasadena and the rest at Mattel, back and forth. And so we tapped the brains of all these people at APH, and Rick was into bowling, and you know, they had a list of titles that we could pick from, and so we started bowling as like our training project. And that, after what, I guess we started started just before John came, so probably September. By February, I think we released PBA Bowling, and then
October,
what?
I started in the middle of October 1980.
Right, so we must, John and I must have started going there like August or September, maybe. We were there a couple of months before you.
Game was
so they were looking pretty serious that Mattel was going to be programming television. They actually started hiring programmers specifically to be Intellivision programmers, and John Soule was the first one hired specifically to be a Intellivision programmer, right?
That's true. However, I didn't know it at the time.
You were being hired for something else. Right?
I knew that the Intellivision had come out. It had been, I'd seen the I got a brochure at the May company, and it was like I would read all of the specifications, and it sounded really great. And I had applied for a job at Mattel, and Mike was the guy who hired, who interviewed me, and I ended up getting hired. And I went to work at the group of the handheld people, which was design and development, D&D, and which is like 30 or 40 engineers, all guys. They were two secretaries who were women. I know we had red badges with a red stripe and a yellow stripe, which meant you could go anywhere except that we had red dots, which means we were the only people allowed to go inside that group. Mattel was sort of into this, particularly with the designing of the Barbie dolls. They just kind of sat me down. Actually, I was. Yeah, the first time I got there, they sat me down at a desk and gave me a copy. Gave me a copy of your friend, the exec, which was the documentation that APH had done, and the GI 1600 assembly language manual. I had done a little bit of 6502 programming before that. So, and what do we have? I guess we had PDP 11s, but you couldn't run any of the PDP. You couldn't do any of the stuff at Mattel at the time. We had no development systems. There were a few rollable PDP 11s with floppies, great big 8-inch floppies, and but APH was still the place where all the work was done. I also like to explain that the Mattel is in Hawthorne, which is 30 miles from Pasadena. And actually, my house was at the other end of the triangle. So on those days where I had to go to both places, I ended up driving 90 miles a round trip to get to one place and then the next. But we were, the APH people were definitely isolated, and they all knew what they were doing, and I didn't know anything. So I went in and looked over the shoulder of Mike and Rick, and they were working in a little abandoned room off the edge of somewhere, and they had a terminal which ran Emacs on the... I thought it was a PDP 20 myself, but I guess it was a PDP 10.
I think they were 11s. We did have
It wasn't an 11. It
no,
was
the
20.
The big system.
We had one big system. We had one big mainframe in the middle of
it. I thought they called it the 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, PDP 20.
And I'm sure there was a lot of politics going on at the time, because I'm sure that APH was not happy about, you know, giving us their secrets, because I ended up didn't see a copy of the exec itself, which is the internal operating system. They were the printout of that. I never got a chance to see it when I was doing Astro Smash. So I just did Astro Smash according to the manual. I worked with Rick and Rick Levine and Mike on bowling for a while. I didn't really, you know, do much, but look over their shoulders and worked on the sound some, which we couldn't. We did go to a bowling alley, actually, and tape the sounds of pins knocking together and try to reproduce it. The television had pretty good sound compared to the Atari, but we found, in retrospect, the sound of two wooden objects is a very complicated sound. So in bowling, if you see it, it looks great, but the pins go ping, 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 which is the best we can come to pins hitting to each other. I guess I started on... I got assigned to do a copy of Asteroids. At the time, the intellectual property implications of video games weren't well-defined, so people were copying each other's games. Not the code. The code was copyrighted, but if you made the game look the same... Nobody complained much. I guess I worked at... I did all my work at Astro Smash at APH in Pasadena. And they were... everybody was nice to me. Nobody was really helpful. I think the head of APH was a guy named Glenn Hightower, who had some interesting psychological... I guess he's like Bill Gates in some ways, and he was a real negotiator and was not inclined to give anything up to Mattel until he'd gotten paid the appropriate amount. So, in fact, we ended up when the development did go to Mattel, they had there was a development system called the Data Widget. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then there was one that APH had that was better. What was that called? Dopey. No, Dopey was in the Data Widget. But APH had a better one that they wouldn't sell to Mattel because Mattel didn't want to pay for it.
Well, so if I could, Mattel, can I point out one thing
about
here?
The graphics system?
Development system.
Yeah, but if I could point out one thing here, just to, is that Hightower made a very bad deal with Mattel. The games, Mattel was paying APH, I believe, something between $20,000 and $30,000 per game with no royalties. Oh. And when they suddenly saw these games selling and they started more and more games, they were trying to figure out how to get more money out of Mattel, and the way to do it was to try to do these development systems and everything. Mattel didn't want to pay for those. And so APH, we want more money because they're seeing Mattel just starting to make a fortune off of this, and they just made a horrible deal to begin with.
And Mattel didn't want to pay the outside source, so doing things in-house, a guy named Jan Chodak, who was there before I was, an engineer, a brilliant guy, developed the development systems that we used, which were boards that actually it was a big ribbon cable that went to a PDP-11 that sat at the end of the cubicle, and there were about 5 or 10 programmers, and it would all run on the PDP-11, download into boards in the PDP-11, and then run on the Intellivision. So that was what was used later at Mattel. That's how we developed, and why don't we go on?
Well, okay. Now, Karen Nugent, now you came in around this time working on graphics on the keyboard component, right?
Yeah, we would do the graphics on graph paper. It was, I think, 8 pixels by 16 pixels, approximately an inch square. And we could only put 2 colors on that. I mean, that's pretty amazing that we got a lot of stuff done. We'd send it to APH. We sent it where you guys work at, and take 2 or 3 days to get it back. So the person who was my boss got his claim to fame by coming up with the trash can for slime. So what we'd do is we'd go and jump in the trash cans at Disney and pull out the broken toys and gallons of slime and play with those in the 2 or 3 days that we weren't developing anything. But we'd get the Barbie dolls and put white out on their face if they were missing arms and legs, they'd test them and throw them away. And we basically played most of the time, but they wanted us to do that because we could develop games and ideas from just playing all the time.
So your boss was Dave James?
Dave James, yeah.
He was the one who actually came up with the animated Running Man, didn't he?
He did that, but they put him into the management of that department because he came up with the trash can for slime.
Okay. But I just want to give him credit for the Running Man that we use today as our logo.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Still blocky after all these years.
Still blocky after all these years. Yeah, well, it was the original design of the Intellivision actually came from General Instruments, and they had designed this chipset to be an entire video game system. But the one thing they did not have in their design was graphics ROM or graphics RAM. They had an idea that you would have a predefined library of graphics, and I think it was Dave James who said, no, that's not going to work. We got to have a way to define graphics, or this thing just isn't going to be good. So I think that was his other big input, was saying that we had to have RAM in there so that the graphics could be designed.
Because we did Dr. Art Galeen and Jack Lane, a bunch of those.
The conversational French.
Yeah. Conversational
French. This was for the keyboard component.
Yeah.
Which had the first keyboard component, which had an overlay graphics that...
It had a decent font at reasonably high resolution.
Yeah, you could get 80. I mean, it wasn't like the 20.
It was 24, right?
12. It was double the back tab resolution. So it would be 64.
40 by 24.
Okay.
It was 6502 was in the keyboard component.
Yeah, and it looked a lot. I mean, the graphics looked a lot like a TRS-80 graphics that had been overlaid, the white type overlaid on white. Alphanumerics overlaid on top of the Intellivision screen. This was in the original keyboard component, which is a long and complicated history that I was actually not involved in.
Was it really
much.
Expensive to produce it? Or?
they had a target price of like $600 or $500. They could never produce it for less than that, so they're losing money on them, which is why they never really came out with them other than in test markets.
I would suspect, I mean, the Intellivision itself at the time cost $300, and the Atari was $200. And this was quite a lot of money, so we didn't typically own them ourselves.
I did some keyboard component programming. I had a blast doing it because it had its own 6502, and so you ended up having to write programs that communicated with each other from the 1600 to the 6502, and it had had better graphics, and it had the tape cassette.
Right.
So it was like this little multimedia machine that you could do some cool stuff with.
Yeah, and the tape drive was real interesting. It was a block addressable tape drive or something like that. So it was essentially like a floppy disk, only it was long and thin.
Yeah.
You know. The other thing that was interesting about tape drive was that instead of it recording digital signals, they figured out how to record digital and analog so that they could get cheaper tapes.
There's that word cheaper again.
Cheaper is good.
But the inexpensive.
Right.
Which thing did you do on the keyboard component?
I worked on spelling challenge and some of the, there was a math challenge one that I did.
Because actually, that was my first job when I got to Mattel, was working on the keyboard component, doing some of the crossword stuff, finishing up, basically, and packaging up some of the crossword games. I'd totally forgotten about that. But that was my first assignment, and Daglo said, okay, go do this, and then I came back like a day later, and said, okay, here's all the cassettes.
Well, okay, now that as we're crossing over from one table to another, you kind of the early days when it's just kind of like crammed together. Now, the sales are starting to take off.
Yeah, let me give one little thing in here. I started in October 1980. In December, they hired Gabriel Baum, who was the head of our programmers. And he was from England, and it was like a month before he actually arrived in Los Angeles to take over. And once they hired him, as before, we'd all worked for Richard Chang, who had done handhelds and everything else. But Gabriel was in charge of Intellivision, and that's the point at which Intellivision, as a separate unity at Mattel, started to grow, and they started to hire people left and right. And
I wish Don were here, because
like
Don
said he would be.
Yeah, like you said.
Not like we're going to give him a hard time or anything.
Right. Well, I'll give him a hard time by telling the story, which I wasn't sure he would have wanted to tell or not. But they were hiring so fast, and so they were hiring this guy who was going to be in charge of the department, but they were also hiring the programmers who were going to work for him. And so actually Don and Gabriel started the same day. So Don and his boss had not met yet. And at the time, Mattel made everybody take a physical. You actually had to go to this off-site clinic, and everybody had to have this physical. And Don and Gabriel actually met sitting on chairs in a waiting room holding cups of urine. And that's what Don gets for not showing up. Anyway, so
my vision of Mattel will never be the same.
So Gabriel starts at the end of 1980. So now in 1981, just frantically, we're growing. Bill and Steve and I all came in 1981. I think of Bill as the old timer. You came in what, in
June 81? Okay. Actually, I interviewed at about March or something like that. I was a student at UCLA. I saw a job posting at the Job Placement Center for, Mattel Electronics computer programmer, and I said, okay, what am I going to do when I graduate? Well, so I interviewed at Hughes, TRW, and Mattel, and I got offers from Hughes and Mattel that were almost the same amount of money. Mattel was actually slightly less, but, irrelevantly less, and I said, I can always get a job in aerospace. I want to try to screw around for a living and see if that's going to work.
And still are.
And still have.
So you started in June.
I think you started
in October?
I started in October.
I started in November. So I always defer to these two as the senior programmers. But by the time we came in, they were just trying to find any place to stick programmers at that point. So
the submarine.
Yes.
Describe that. Our facility, we nicknamed the submarine because it was this little tiny area right off the main hallway in Mattel's manufacturing facility. And anybody who's been by in Los Angeles in the old days, when you drove to the Los Angeles airport, there was this big factory on the side of the road that said, home of Barbie and Hot Wheels. And it had this six-story building, I think it was, and then a giant, single-story manufacturing, ordinary-looking manufacturing joint.
It's now a Ford dealership.
Actually, it's a big box retailer thing, which has a Home Depot and a Toys R Us.
But at the corner now, they put a...
At the corner is a Ford dealership? Okay, so the six-story building is not a Ford dealership.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's completely gone. There's nothing left of it. But at the time, it was a manufacturing. They were making Hot Wheels, really, in the factory, and Barbies and stuff like that. And so they had these giant forklifts going up and down this concrete-lined hallway, and we were right off the hallway in this raw concrete
space that was probably a third or a quarter of, actually it was about a quarter of the space of this room here. We had about a dozen of us in there.
And narrow.
So it was very heavy.
Yeah, very narrow.
Hence the name, the submarine.
Yes. Right.
Very narrow with cubicles along it.
And, you know, little tiny cubicles for each one of our desks. And then we had the APH data widget sitting on a table because there was only one data widget. And, you know, when you were debugging your code, you do your best to write your code and figure out what was going on. And then you have to go over there, download it, play it in the machine, see what was wrong, then go back to your desk and figure out the next step. So it was really rather cumbersome and burdensome process.
Let me interject. It just occurred to me. The data widget was a blue box.
That was the white box with the blue sides and the switches all along the front. Wasn't that the data widget?
Yeah.
It was a hardware emulator.
The operating system inside was with what we call Dopey. And what I was telling about before was wrong. That APH developed a better downloading system that was not called Dopey. It was called Merlin or something, and that's the one that we and Mattel wouldn't buy. So we stuck with Dopey for until we built our own. Do it myself, but Mattel built our own systems to save
money.
It was interesting. One thing that I noticed very quickly is that there were two types of programmers at Mattel: the ones who debugged intuitively, and the ones who debugged logically. The intuitive ones would look at the screen and go, "I just went black. What could make it go black? I might have done this," and they'd reprogram that, and then wait and see. And they'd try like five or six different things, and maybe they'd spend half a day just kind of like by trial and error seeing what made the screen go black. And then those ones would immediately get the data widget out and just start stepping through code line by line. And Mike was that type. Mike would just immediately, so then put it on the data widget and just one step by step go through each line of code. And I was more the intuitive type. I would just like, maybe it did this. and it generally took a blend of two people. It generally took like, you know, after about an hour or so, I'd probably like, Mike? You know, so I think you probably were more of a logical.
I was definitely a beneficiary of the Mike Minkoff magic, because the worst bug I ever had was in Spacehawk, where I had put a bunch of code into the interrupt routine, and so the interrupts were taking more than a 30th of a second, or 60th of a second. I didn't really quite understand what was going on. I mean, I was just out of college, and I'd done some assembly language programming, but nothing with interrupts things in this way. And so I had this weird bug where every once in a while the guy would suddenly go like this tall on the screen and all the stuff would change around and start scrolling in weird directions. It wouldn't crash. It would just get really, really funky. And, you know, there wasn't a single line of code anywhere in the system that would make the guy go quadruple height and, you know, and look funny. And yet it was happening. And so finally I was able to isolate it down to the point I had to sit down with Mike. And Mike, it took me about a week and a half to find that bug. Because it would only happen after about 10 minutes of play. And so you'd sit there, oh, yeah, I got it. And then about a day later, it's like, crap, there it is again. And he finally found it. It took Mike, though, to actually sit down with me and say, now, look at this piece of code here. What if it was... And we're like, oh, okay. And then, you know, he was the one who actually found it, because he said, there's where your problem's going to be. You shouldn't have done that. Right. And sure enough, that was it.
But we still felt, I mean, in 81, it was still very much a, you know, we're just jammed everywhere. We're just pushed over. The submarine you're talking about, one thing is the walls had been temporarily put up. They didn't go all the way up to the ceiling. So in the next room, there were testers, and they were testing, when I first started, they were testing the CNCs. So as I'm programming, all I'm hearing is, the cow says, "Murr." The horse says, "Nyeh." And I'm trying to work.
They were lighting, you know, lighting plastic toys on fire.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to dodge all the radio-controlled cars in the...
Yeah, there would be
these... Radio-controlled cars running around the hallway.
As you would go, we'd had to walk from where we were to the cafeteria, which was down the hall, and seated on stools in this hallway were the most bored-looking women I've ever seen, who were sitting there with these radio-controlled things, testing these radio-controlled cars going up and down. As we would walk to lunch, I swear they were trying to hit us with those things, just banging into our ankles with these things. And the forklifts you were talking about, they were all electric, so there was this ozone. So there was this ozone smell constantly. So you had the ozone smell, the radio-controlled cars, the CNC for the next thing. We didn't have enough systems. It was all time-sharing systems. So you had one computer that probably could probably service like 8 terminals, and we had 10 terminals hanging off of it and all of this. And someone was always doing something like there was a problem, and they'd come in and they would shut it off while you were in the middle of working on something. something, they'd say,
it sounds like this job sucked. Why
it did, I tell you.
Oh, no, it was great.
Because it was the
an
most,
adventure.
Because, yeah, we were creating new things. The two of you were working on when I started, you were working on Space Spartans, on the IntelliVoice for the first time.
I'd already finished Space Hawk, huh? We should mention that one for 30 seconds, because that's the end of his story.
About asteroids.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people know the story. It's on the website, which is at televisionlives.com.
Or if you can't remember that, it's also astrosmash.com. We'll also take you to it.
I've been ordered to do a copy of Asteroids, which is, I found very quickly, is not at all suited for the intelligence system. For the intelligence system, you can have a maximum of 8 moving objects. And if you've got your little ship is one and your shot is another one, that leaves you with a total of 6 asteroids, which isn't going to get very interesting. But they wanted me to do it, and I had the idea of doing... I like missile command myself. I like stuff coming out of the sky and randomly, and you shoot at it. I didn't like space invaders. So because Gabriel hadn't been hired but didn't show up yet, and I was working in Pasadena most of the time, I did that game instead of doing Asteroids. And... because I thought it was going to be more fun. And I was a little new to the corporate environment. I've been working at UCLA before that in research. And that we would burn... We didn't even have... You know, there's no way that the management of a hotel could know what you're doing unless they went to Pasadena or you burned a T-card and took the card back. That's the prom system. And I made a T-card and I took it back to the system And I definitely got a chat with Richard Chang, who I didn't understand most of what he said ever. He's Chinese, and sure. but he certainly gave the impression that I should have. He suggested that I do what I had been told to do instead of doing a different game completely. So I never abandoned the first game, the game of my love game, which was the stuff falling down. But I did both of the games in them. So we had in the original cartridge a version of Asteroids where you sort of floated in space and the rocks floated and you shot it, and I was never enthusiastic about that.
Yeah, you could tell.
And then the other game, which had the rocks falling down and the thing at the bottom shooting, and that's the game everybody liked. Everybody liked that. They liked to play it. So when they finally got to the CES in Chicago, which would have been in June of 1981, it went out with both games in it. It didn't go out with both games. I should say that we went to CES with both games, and Atari and Mattel's thinking on intellectual property had changed a little bit since I started the project 6 months earlier. So that when they put the cartridge in at the Consumer Electronics Show, an hour or so later, the Atari lawyers showed up at the booth and said, "That's Asteroids, and we own that, and that's our intellectual." They didn't use the word intellectual property in those days. I said, "You can't do that game." So they pulled it out of the box, and it was a big disappointment to me because that's the game I'd been working on. And I was at CES that year. Don't know why. Actually, I was one of the only Intellivision. I was there to make sure the Intellivisions worked, I guess. And then after about a week or so after I got back from CES, I was working on the next game. I guess I was working on B-17 Bomber at the time. And Gabriel came by and stuck his head in and said, "Could you just get rid of that Asteroids-like game and go to the other one, the Falling Rocks?" Just so I said, "Sure, no problem." I put a hard jump around this. This was originally a selection screen. This original game, by the way, is available on Intellivision. one of the Intellivision... this is the CDs. We actually reconstructed the original game. So we put a hard jump in there, and what you got now is Asteroids as it's known now.
Astro Smash.
Yes. I wanted to call it Falling Rocks, but you know, people in the marketing came up with Astro Smash, which is really a much better name than Falling Rocks. and then Bill started in June, and...
Gabriel walked from your office to mine and said, "Take that out." And then he walked over to me and said, "See this? Make something else out of it. Make something that's like Asteroids but isn't."
So he had a game which I had written, went into 4K of code, including graphics. and he just had to strip out everything that was... Well, he just had to make a good game, take a really stinky game and make a good game out of it, and not have a whole lot of space to do it in.
And also not step on Atari.
Yeah, yeah, so, and he had my my brilliantly commented code to work with, so he was also learning the system for the first time.
Yeah,
so
this is my first exercise in television programming. Everybody else got this little sample app called Killer Tomatoes. Instead, I got handed the full source code to Astro Smash and said, here, make something else out of this. And actually, the code was reasonable enough and reasonable to understand. It wasn't that bad, and I was naive and stupid and didn't know how hard it was anyway. And just started thinking about it and saying, okay, well, what can I do that's going to be different but also going to be fun, and I can do it with 8 moving objects, which was a real challenge. And thinking about it and saying, okay, well, what can I do that's going to be different but also going to be fun, and I can do it with 8 moving objects, which was a real challenge. And so I came up with some ideas and tried them out and tried to play around with some things. And I'd been a big fan of games like Space War. And so in Space War, you had 2 navigation methods. You either had the jump, 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 and no acceleration, or you had the acceleration-based model. And so I put in a couple of different options that I thought would be kind of fun, and then set the defaults to the ones that I thought were the best for play purposes. And I really liked the feel. And so I put in an acceleration model, because John's game didn't have much in the way of acceleration. It didn't have much in the way of scrolling beyond the basic scroll stuff. And didn't have much in the way of the way the rocks would come and go as you went off the screen and stuff like that. And so I added in a bunch of stuff like that. Also changed the thing in the center from being the spaceship, the triangular spaceship, to a guy in a jetpack. Because, well, why not? And that proved to work out fairly well also. And then I got this idea of doing something like a bubble in space instead of these other things. And that was just sort of a random idea of, well, what can we draw with, you know, so few pixels, it's going to look half decent, it's not going to be a rock, because it can't be a rock, so what else is it going to be? And the cool thing about the bubble is that then that allowed us to do a really neat bubble popping sound effect. So I had several bloop, 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 bloop sound effects, which worked out really good. But I actually had, the hardest part of that was, because you've got this bubble, which is basically a circle with nothing in the middle of it, it became an interaction problem, because all the hardware, all the gameplay is based on the fact that the little hardware thing interacts with the other little hardware thing. And so we ran into a problem of having to actually design the artwork so that there were extra pixels here and there on those bubbles and extra pixels on the little shots that you shot out so that it would make sure that the odds of you hitting them were high enough that it actually worked effectively. So that was the biggest challenge on that thing, was actually to get that to work well. And then even when the bubbles popped, if one bubble would hit another bubble as it was popping, it would trigger it. And so we actually had to put in extra pixels on the explosions also, so that when it was exploding, there was enough dots that they would interact and they would tend to hit one another. And that was, there was actually a fairly delicate bit of coding. You know, this came up yesterday because somebody was asking me, well, what was it like and how did the artists give you the art? And this is one of those weird cases where back in those days, the artwork was intimately tied to the hardware, and oftentimes you had to have... It wasn't just a matter of the programmer did the art because there were no artists, because there were virtually no artists in the group, but also sometimes you had to, because you had to sit there at the pixel level and do these things. So I actually did most of the artwork for that myself. I just sat there with that same graph paper, you know, and sat there with a little pencil drawing these things out and saying, yeah, that looks about right. Now let's move a dot here from here to here. You know, you can get away with that. You can't do that anymore. I don't do art. Well, I don't do art anymore.
And as another example, doesn't the bullet in Astro Smash get longer as the game speeds up?
Oh, yes.
In order to make sure that it doesn't miss any of the rocks. Because if you kept the same small bullet that you have at the beginning, when you speed up the game, you'll have a rock coming down and the bullet will just jump right over it and miss it completely. So they have to make the bullet long enough so that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I was lucky in Astro. I didn't really know much about computer science, but I early on I went to a system of tables where everything that, how many rocks were launched and how big they were, and a lot of other things were determined by looking up at your difficulty level in the game. And I found that the original shots, when you're starting to get slow, the shots are very small. And if things are moving fast, you're shooting at stuff and it's not interacting. So I just put something in the table to make the shots bigger and bigger. And the reason there are 2 shots in Astro Smash is because I really disliked the asteroid system, where once you shot something, you had to wait for it to hit or go off the screen before you could get a second shot. I thought, in a shooting game, you ought to be able to shoot as much as possible. So,
It's really interesting you did that.
There's
I did the same thing in my game too.
There's the base that's just moving. There's two shots, and that left me only five objects floating in the screen, which would be rocks or spinners or whatnot. And to this day, they're using the publicity photo that was not a photo. It was an artist's conception of what the screen looked like, which always has more than eight objects on it. So the screen that they've been reprinting for 24 years is not possible in the real game.
But your persistence of vision creates it. One thing I should point out here in 1981, when we were talking about the submarine, is that was Mike's group. Don Daglow had a group that was elsewhere because they didn't have room for all of us in one place. So we were kind of being jammed all over the Mattel building. But finally, after 1981, that so much money was being made by Mattel Electronics, by Intellivision, that they decided this was going to be a real thing, a real deal. So at the end of 91, they spun it off into its own company, Mattel Electronics.
81.
Did I say 91?
Yeah.
Okay, 81. The decades are going by so quickly. So at the end of 81, they spin it off in its own company, Mattel Electronics, and they decide they're going to move it into this beautiful new building down Rosecrans that's this fantastic thing that's not built yet. So they're going to put us all in one location. There was a warehouse that Mattel had behind the main building that I think Northrop was in or something, and they kicked them out finally, and they moved us into this, and this was going to be now the programming office. It was still a warehouse, and they were designing it and painting it and making it into this beautiful facility for us while we were moving into it. And while we were trying to hook up into it. So that's kind of how 1982 began, which is when these people over here kind of came in. So we have Joe, who's doing graphics, Michelle, who's a programmer, and Dave Warhol is a programmer. So you guys all kind of came in as the systems were being built, as there was no elevator yet, the building wasn't painted yet. And now everybody's being jammed into one place in this new company. And again, we're growing by leaps and bounds. We've started from when we were there, 12, 13 programmers, yeah. And now we're moving up into 50, 60 programmers.
Well, and the elevator was a problem for Lee Barnes. We had one programmer who was in a wheelchair, and there was no way for him to get onto our floor, so he was working for me, and unfortunately, he was an Apple II programmer. And unfortunately, he was stuck downstairs in the accounting department.
Yes, he was programming Apple Baseball, I think, or something. And,
I can't remember which one it was.
And he's down, and no one knew he was. You know, it's like the poor guy's down there and doesn't know any of the other programmers. So what was it like as you guys came in? And now you're in this big warehouse and not enough systems to go around.
I've been trying to keep mental notes as we come down the table this morning. So many things I wanted to talk about. But it was like a three-ring circus with the construction going on at that time. I remember it might have been the very first day I started. There was a horrible sound. The lights went out. And I think it was you told me that some poor guy had cut through a major electrical line.
There were no windows in this business office.
The elevator going in. So
some guy fried himself to death. You know, like the very first day I got there. So, Peter said something.
That was a programmer who didn't do what he was supposed to do.
The philosophy at APH was you design one to throw away.
Yeah.
It got to the point where I felt like everything I was designing was going to be thrown away. You should have a special panel just on the marketing aspects of all this. But Keith was my manager at the time, and he had a philosophy where even though everybody was really putting in the overtime, technically, but not reflected financially, he really thought that you should bring everything to the party from your life outside the office. And Mike was a perfect example with his gin expertise. Or Dave's a fantastic musician. He used to code incredible sound effects that, you know, we've been wrestling with. I had my own I had my own sort of problems. And Keith always would just say, Joe, Joe, Joe. He was like my data widget. Here's your problem. There was a lot of stuff all going on at the same time. You couldn't be bored with anything. Everything changed every day.
I remember one time Mike came in to me and said, Keith, you're going to have to talk to Joe. I said, why? I said, look at this phone charge. He's got $200 in phone charges on his phone for the last one. And so I go, Joe, you can't do this. You can't, you know, you can make some personal calls, but $200, that's outrageous, all of this. And then at the end of the meeting, Joe points out that, you know, I'm sharing my phone with four other programmers right now. It's like, oops. We didn't have enough development systems. We didn't have enough phones. We just didn't have enough of anything at that point.
I didn't come from a technical background at all. I was I'd taken a few minor classes at first year of college, trying to get into the fine arts program. But was anybody, any of you guys ever like belong to Indian Guides when you were a kid? It was like an LA clone of Cub Scouts or something. Anyway, I had a book. It was called Indian Crafts by Paul Hogan, and half of the book was graph paper designed so that you could simulate Indian bead patterns and stuff, you know, to make some kind of homemade crafts. It all came full circle with this graph paper business and lack of development tools at the beginning. I dropped out of my basic math classes in high school, and it got to the point where I had to learn the hex code and actually convert these little 8x16 boxes into the hexadecimal, alphanumeric stuff. And just, you know, for a basic in television screen, I would end up like with these small phone books worth of code, you know, that I had written out. And that was, I thought I was really overreaching myself at that point. But
just to explain that a little more, exactly how that works, is what would happen is these guys would work on the graph paper. And so as you're doing the graph paper, you're essentially, you know, filling in a square, not filling in a square. And then you would take that 8-bit wide for the card or for the moving object that you're designing and turn that into binary, where you've filled it in. That's a 1, and it's a 0 there where there's nothing filled in. And so then that becomes your binary code. And then you have 8 of those to define a card on the screen. So you have how many cards on a screen? 240 or something like that. So each one of those has to have 8-bit... binary characters on it, which then we translate into hexadecimal to make it easier. And so all of that had to be done initially by hand to give that code to the programmer to put the graphics into the game.
When was it in Intellivision 4? They had a prototype. I was very fortunate. I got to work on a lot of the prototype stuff in preparation for CES. Atari didn't seem to have any problem copying our games once they were put on display, though. What I swear, every game that I started to work on and was put on some type of display at CES that we didn't produce, Atari had a version out 6 months later. I remember Keith came to me and said, Joe, good news, you're going to get to work on the new Intellivision 4, twice the resolution. And it was like, twice the code. It's not twice, you know, it was four times the amount of this stuff. So, all by hand.
Well, I'm glad to hear that other people came in and had things canceled on me, because I think when I first came in, I think everything I got assigned to was being canceled. But I came in from a background working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory doing test software, assembly language programmer. And so when I got to this creative thing, it was like totally different. And some of the things that I learned, even though I never got anything into production, I was learning the thing about the graphics. I wasn't an artist, but I had to do graphics. And one of the things that I had on one of the programs that I was working on was a helicopter, and had to have a blade that was moving and everything. How do you do that with those limited pixels? And so just trial and error, you know, working one thing after another. Finally, I realized that you make one blade get smaller, one blade get bigger, and the thing starts looking like it's rotating. You have to get a certain speed for it to actually look like the blade on this helicopter is rotating. So that was, you know, one thing. Another thing was music. I remember programming the William Tell Overture for this game, and it was all binary. And so you do it all in binary, and then you convert it to octal or or something to get it to actually run. But it was very time-consuming stuff to be able to get things out. But yeah, you're talking about tools and resources that you didn't have. Well, I was at JPL where we had 24 programmers fighting over one mini computer to do our work with the big disk drive things that you're talking about.
The Winchester platters.
Yeah, and it was like, so when I came to Mattel, it was like, wow, you know, everybody, you can burn an EEPROM to test your program. I was like, yeah, really cool. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, where I came from. And there were female programmers. I'm, you know, one of them. So, you know, not very many, as you can see by the audience, too. It's not really a female world, I guess, for video game development. But it was quite interesting.
And Dave, you came in?
I came in about June of 82. And probably about 50 or 60 people on the floor at that time. It was probably about four development systems for every five or six people, and I was the fifth or sixth person. I shared an office with the fifth and sixth person. But started out with a lot of documentation, and then we would just kind of wander around looking for either a data widget or somebody who was away from their desk or who might have been out that week or something like that. And so we're all just kind of sharing development equipment. But in the period of time I was there, it's almost like due to I won't say desperation, but ingenuity of certain staff members, there were a lot of really innovative solutions that the staff came up with to overcome these shortcomings. One of them was a program written by Eric Wells called Mr. Color, where we didn't have any way to do any graphic development, so he wrote an Intellivision game that was a graphics editor. So through the hand controller, you could turn on and off pixels, and you could position them on the screen. So completely interactively, none of this hex code stuff anymore.
That was like a Christmas present.
Oh, yeah. You could actually design graphics in real time using the hand controller on the screen, and then we would save it off and it would turn it into, you had to cut and paste some lines and you'd get them into your game. And that was a fantastic innovation. And then as far as debugging goes, Rick Koenig wrote a debugger that worked on the Intellivision. How he did that was beyond, I think, anybody. But you'd link it in, and he would insert a little, if you wanted to set a breakpoint in your Intellivision game, he'd put a jump instruction going to his monitor, and then his monitor would rewrite the screen with the contents of all the registers, and then say, what do you want to do now? And he'd go, well, I'll single step. And you'd press a button, and then it would rewrite, you know, using the Intellivision graphics itself, would overwrite the screen with what was going on inside the machine. You could change register contents, debug it, and then you say, okay, I want to run it again. And then it would restore the screen and your game would go. So these people were coming up with innovations that helped increase productivity using more or less the tools that we had at hand. The things there was everybody was... Everybody was really excited about it, but the one thing I will remember is it's the first time I realized what corporate politics were. We weren't allowed to talk to or even help the people in some of these other departments because of these little empire wars that were going on inside Mattel, which seemed totally counterproductive to me. It's like, you know, aren't we all working on the same for the same company here? Oh, no, this guy wants in on this guy's turf, and so it's like, you know, geez, just let us write our games here. So there was some of that going on at the top level, which was a little discouraging. At that point in time, the structure was becoming a little more obvious, where there would be group leaders or little committees of reviewing games and a lot of game concepts coming through, where people would get together and kind of comment on them and filter them through and things like that. So the organization started to mature, but I guess it was, you know, only a year or two old from where it had started with just the handful of people into the, you know, the larger structures with the different focuses and things like that.
I want to mention two things about the tools you talked about. One is Mr. Color. If you want to see what that was like and see what it was like to develop that on our collection in Television Rocks, is an unreleased game that was called Game Factory, done by David Stifel. And Game Factory, it went full circle. He took the Mr. Color and put it into a game that allowed you to design your own Intellivision game. The very simplistic, but the tools that are in there are the Mr. Color tools. And the second thing is the debugger you talked about, the World Championship Baseball, the one-player version of baseball, could never fully figure out all the bugs in it. And Mike Minkoff tried for a long time trying to figure out, and he used that Koenig debugger. Anyway, Mattel wouldn't send it out because it had a bug in it, but Terry Valesky at INTV had no such qualms, and he sent it out with the bug still in it. And so if you play World Championship Baseball and it crashes, what you see on the screen is the debugger that Dave was talking about. It actually is showing you the registers and what is in those registers as the thing crashed. So if you want to see what those things look like. Anyway, so now, you know, right about the time that we finally kind of got all our act together and got enough systems for everybody and got everything in, Mattel shut down Intellivision. So it's gone. But then a couple years later, it comes back. Terry Valesky has bought the rights to it, starts INTV Corporation, and now decides that he wants to develop new games. So now, Dave, and I guess Ray, you worked on some of those for Dave. So now what was it like now where you have no more corporate structure and just out of your home you're developing games?
Yeah, at that point in time, I guess... Terry wanted to. He got a tremendous response in a mail order program, 8% from a direct mail campaign. Decided to pick up to start new development, and I guess actually Bill and I were both kind of bidding or interested in the work. But Terry went with my group. I think We've based on the bar tab he left me with, I think we've agreed that it was okay for
it, yeah, well, it ended up being a wash. You ended up doing it, and you ended up getting stuck with the bills.
Yeah, yeah. I think the reason we went with you instead of you is that you had lawyers.
That may have been true, actually. I was very persnickety with Velasky. I didn't trust him from the day I met him.
Fortunately, I had a friend who was doing hardware design, and I had originally come up with a scheme to take a hand controller from an Intellivision hand controller, hook it up to a parallel port of the PC, and download through the parallel port into a hand controller, into RAM, into a RAM card. It seemed to me like that would work, so I started toying around with that, and I was talking to my hardware designer friend, and he was like, "Oh no, I'll just make you a ROM emulator." So he designed a PC. We didn't really have IBM PCs at Mattel, but he designed a PC card that had 32K of RAM on it, and it was shared between the PC bus, and it had a little cable coming out with an Intellivision cartridge on it. And once he got these things up, he did them wire wrapped boards, and probably took maybe 6 weeks, maybe a month before he got his first one. Plugged it into an Intellivision, loaded a ROM image into it, and boom, we were playing Intellivision games from a PC based card. And then he went into a production run, so we probably made 24 wire just printed circuit boards that were Intellivision development stations. And these were great because they were better than anything we had at Mattel at the time. You just compile your program on a PC, copy it into the shared RAM, and boom, you're off and running. We had Mr. Color, we had the debuggers and all that. But at this point in time, it was just a loosely knit group of contractors, ex-Mattel employees, Ray in L.A., Rick Koenig up in the Bay Area, Connie Goldman, who I still work with today, graphics designer, did the graphics for us. She was down in San Diego. I do sound effects. Probably had a couple more people who would pitch in. Steve Ettinger, originally in L.A., moved up to Seattle and was working up there, doing games up there. Pardon?
Mark Urbanek.
Mark Urbanek, another L.A. person. Really working quite effectively over the phone lines. These were 16K games. If somebody was sending an art file back and forth, it could be 4 or 5K. 2,400 baud modems, we would really effectively work pretty well just with the kind of a virtual corporation of contractors. And we were able to produce probably 20, 25 games in that environment because we already knew the architects. We already knew how to work with each other, and it was pretty effective. I went on to continue to do that for 8-bit Nintendo games, but by the time you get to the 16-bit systems like the Genesis and the Super Nintendo, the team size required and the interdependency between them made it so that you just couldn't communicate effectively from remote locations. And I ended up getting offices myself to solve that. But the Intellivision stuff were really quite successfully able to do just over the phone lines.
And remember when I brought up earlier that the plan was we were in that warehouse building temporarily because they were building this new beautiful building on Rosecrans. Of course, Mattel Electronics went out of business. Mattel had a 10-year lease on that building, which I think they sublet to Hughes for a number of years. And then it became an office building that that other companies could move into. And finally, after all these years, Dave, where is your company located now?
I had my eyes on the plaza at Continental Park for 20 years. and just in July of this year, we took out office space on the top floor of that building that we should have been.
And his company, Real Time Associates, does the programming on the PlayStation 2, Xbox, the GameCube version of Intellivision. So Intellivision programming is now being done in that building. Finally, where it belongs after all these years. Ray, what was your attitude when Dave came to you and said, "Hey, there's going to be more games done for Intellivision"?
I think I said, "You're crazy."
And then you said?
I said, "Well, if they're going to pay us for it, this is a villain. If they're going to pay us for it, I'll do it." You know, because shortly before Dave came to us, I had seen, you get these flyers in the mail that says, come to this timeshare presentation and we'll give you a free gift. And they always list the free gifts that you get. And you can always pick out the one that you're going to get. Right, and the item on the timeshare was a valuable video game system worth $200. And so Valesky was dumping Intellivision stuff to these timeshare people. It's like, I'm going, I can't even give this stuff away. Why do they need more games for it?
Gee, the ones I got always, the one, it was always an Aquarius computer system.
It's a terrifying product.
Yeah, Mike's the one that had the Aquarius.
But the thing that was so cool about being able to do those games for Valesky was when Mattel shut down, we had a bunch of games that were kind of in development that we were thinking about that, oh, that would be kind of fun. And I was working on what ended up being Diner, which it was going to be the sequel to Masters of the Universe, which is another game that I did. And so we had, you know, Beast Man and He-Man and all these, and Skeletor and all these bad guys in there, and it was looking kind of castle-y and stuff. And Dave goes, well, we really need a sequel to Burger Time. We don't need Masters, because Mattel's never going to give us the rights to Masters anyway. So we need a sequel to Burger Time. And I go, well, that's not the game I want to do. I want to do, you know, Masters. And so we talked about it, and I go, well, let me just do an experiment. So I threw the hot dogs in my Masters simulation, and we go, yeah, I like it. And so all of a sudden, you know, this thing that had all these kind of dark connotations, all of a sudden it's got hot dogs in it and eggs and bananas and things. And we just worked with it, and we go, well, how can we, you know, so we just kept playing with it and you know, well, what's the gameplay? It's like we got this really cool looking, but, you know, so we had to work on putting gameplay in and stuff. And but the thing that was so cool is something that I really had fun with, I actually got to finish for some, you know, on somebody else's dime. You know, I'm working full time, but it's like I'm going home, going, okay, now I get to really program because this is a game that I want to work on. And so it was really fun.
We just have about 10 minutes left. Do questions from anyone out there? Yes.
Is there a story behind how George Clinton became the spokesman
for? Well, the I think it was just because the marketing department realized that sports was something that they could really sell the games on, because at the time people didn't really know what a video game was, and you're trying to show on television why our video game is better than their video game. We sell the games on, because at the time people didn't really know what a video game was, and you're trying to show on television why our video game is better than their video game. And the one thing that everybody knows is what, you know, a baseball diamond looks like, what a football field looks like. So that was something very easy to show on TV. Here's what the Atari baseball game looks like. Here's what, you know, the Intellivision football game or baseball game looks like. And you could just tell instantly, oh, that's a baseball diamond, that's not. And so they wanted to go with the sports. Plimpton at the time was very well known for his participatory articles about doing sports. He had played with, what, with the Detroit team in football, and he had done boxing and everything. He'd written these articles for Sports Illustrated and books and movies,
yeah,
based on that.
He pitched an inning as in spring training with some team.
So he was well known as a sports writer and as this guy who had not just written about sports but had actually participated himself. So he was kind of this guy who could say for all these different sports, I know these sports, and this is, to
this
me,
is
obviously the better.
So. I know these sports, and this isn't this sport.
Right. And so that's why he was chosen, was because of that reputation. So at the time, Plimpton now is kind of, I mean, maybe not as well known at the time. He, during the 60s or 70s, he had done an entire series of TV specials where he had done this participation, where he had gone to a circus and done trapeze work. He was in a John Wayne movie, and they had done these entire series of George Plimpton specials. So he's well known as being a guy who not only wrote about stuff, but actually participated in it. And that was the image that they wanted. That. Yep. the thing about
over a bunch of wine.
What was that?
Over a bunch of wine.
Yeah. Mattel, you know, didn't want the names of the programmers known. They wanted to keep us anonymous because there was so much headhunting going on and fear of Atari stealing people away. So all of the magazines that wanted to do articles, Mattel wouldn't allow them unless Mattel had total control. And TV Guide was the only magazine that essentially let Mattel have total control over what was said, what was reported, what the final thing was going to be, line-by-line control of the whole thing. So they essentially staged the whole thing. They handpicked a bunch of us. Normally, what we would call a blue sky session was just kind of informally held in a park or whatever, but they had them at, we actually had to go to the corporate offices. That blue sky session was held in the paneled corporate offices.
Mahogany Grove.
Was it the restaurant?
The first part. The beginning of it. The first part was we went to the corporate offices, and the vice president, senior vice president of PR was there.
Spencer Boyce?
Yes. Spencer Boyce was there checking on everything, and he was there, but Mike was there, Don Daglow was there.
I was there.
You were there. I was there.
Jason.
John was the sole.
You were Josh. Josh.
Yeah, but I don't recall being in a boardroom. This happened in the morning. I may not have been there.
No, no, no. You were Josh.
Later on, I
Gabriel, they gave the name Hal, and the gentle 36-year-old leader of the Blue Skyman. And I forget what your fake name was.
I can't remember.
They gave you a fake name.
They gave me a fake name, absolutely.
Yeah, I was there, but I didn't get a fake name. But I was the one who came up with the Ouija board idea, so that's at least my idea was mentioned.
And in the
Bill Goodrich was there. Mm-hmm. You had to have Bill Goodrich was there. Bill Goodrich was our resident character. He was this guy.
One of.
No, we're the normal ones. This is the normal group. Bill Goodrich was the guy. Bill was a real aficionado of the Renaissance Pleasure Fair. And so he...
And dressed in bathed leggings.
Yes. He liked to keep in character all year long. So, he had an opinion and an expertise on everything. I remember one time walking down a hall with Mark Urbanek, and we suddenly just heard from behind us Bill saying, "Well, Nassau's position on that is..." And Mark turned around and said, NASA's position. What do you know about what NASA's position is on anything?" And he goes, "Well, he was always carrying around a 2-liter bottle of warm Dr. Pepper
he sawed it off.
That
two-liter bottle of Dr. Pepper with the top sawed off, using it as a cup. He'd be sitting there in meetings with this massive slug of cola. I could not
warm.
Warm cola. Yeah.
Yeah. He would punctuate everything he would say with a nice swig of that. Anyway, we could tell Goodrich stories. That would just be a seminar by itself. But yeah, they started it off, and you know, because they wanted to be very controlled, and then they took us to Barnaby's, which was a hotel down the street, which I got a good Bill Goodrich story for that too, where we actually then they had a room there that they had set up in the hotel for us to. Joy Sylvian came in with toys and dumped them out, and we were all supposed to make up games based on these toys. It was all a very artificial thing. The whole Blue Sky Ranger name came about was from the the writer of the article, Howard Polskin, I think his name is. He came up with that name, and because he said, "Well, what do you guys call yourself?" And it's like, "Well, we're the application software development crew." And it's like, okay. What else do you call yourself? And well, that's what we are. So he came up with the name Blue Sky Rangers, and Gabriel, who was our vice president, said that's the lamest thing I've ever heard. But Spencer Boyce convinced him, twisted his arm, said, let them do it. And so he compromised. The article says they are the Blue Sky Rangers. Never says that we call ourselves the Blue Sky Rangers. Said they are the Blue Sky Rangers, and so they compromised on that. And Mark Urbanek and I knew that Gabriel hated that name. So when the article came out, we had T-shirts made up with this Blue Sky Ranger logo with Gabriel's face on it. Yet how? Oh, there we go. There it is right there. Here's the T-shirt.
How we trust.
And how we trust with Gabriel's face. Just to mock the whole thing. That coincidentally, Michelle Mock. The name is stuck. The name is stuck after 20 years. I guess it's helped identify us with people. But it was just started out as a joke, and it's still kind of a joke. But yeah, we're the Blue Sky Rangers. So that's kind of how it came about. It was just because, you know, who else but TV Guide is going to let you control entirely what is written about you.
Way back then.
Yeah, for the press. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, now you get Fox News to do it.
There's two things I want to say, not about the article, but two things that have occurred to me over this weekend as I've listened to other panels and other people speak. And one is that, unlike a lot of the companies that are doing video games, Mattel was a really big company to start with. It was a Fortune 500 company, the biggest toy company in America. So we didn't start in a garage, and we didn't have this informal things. We developed that as, and I think Gabriel, I think he did a remarkably good job of insulating us from the Mattel culture, which was really based on doing, you know, plastic toys that cost under $10. you know, low cost. And so, but my experience was different going to Mattel, where it was like already. I mean, I knew Mattel from when I was a kid. It was Mattel. If it's Mattel, it's Swell was the name, the advertising line back in the 60s. So that's one difference between our experience and another one. And something unrelated which has occurred to me is that we're always seem to be bashing marketing people, and the Mattel marketing people had certain fixed ideas that we thought were bizarre, like they liked licensing things. So
but
they
not
thought
games.
No.
They licensed games.
They
licensed
cool
characters.
Well, yeah, but I was saying early on they said, well, if we do bowling, it's one thing, but if we do PBA bowling, that'll sell a whole lot more because the Professional Bowling Association, or football, NFL football, that's better. They didn't really care about what the game was. It was getting the name on it. But when I started at Mattel, the first thing I started on, actually, before Astro Smash was, and somebody just threw this at me and said, we've always wanted to do a motorcycle game. Can you do anything? And I tried it for a couple of days, couldn't come up with a good idea. I wanted to have a point of view motorcycle game. Yeah, I was dreaming, and that wasn't possible. But I think everybody, at some point, a lot of people, like maybe 10 different people, took a crack at the motorcycle game before it got finished. And when I was there, the marketing people were always saying, we can do a motorcycle game, and we can do a boxing game. Can't you people get it done? And, you know, no, we couldn't, and I wasn't very interested in that stuff. But the marketing people were right, because those are the games that are really hot now. You know, shooting games, driving games, fighting games. So they knew what they wanted. It just was not, I don't think the television was well suited for that. So, and also they were very, marketing people were always very nice to me, but I don't know if that was appropriate. So I think
before or after you wrote Astro Smash?
Well, afterwards.
You sell a million games, they're real nice to you.
You know, and there's a very different cultural difference between marketing people and programming people, but I think we're a little unkind to them when we consider them to be idiots, which they are idiots when it comes to game design, but they're not idiots when it comes to selling stuff. So that's all I wanted to say.
One last question. I think we've got to clear out of here. Yes? What does the future hold for Intellivision?
Cha-ching.
That's for Keith.
What was that?
Marketing presentation. Here it comes.
Yeah, now I turn for a marketing person, so now I'll be the idiot. Obviously, we're trying to get the old games onto as many platforms. We're trying to get some of the licensed games. The nice thing is that as we've been able to sell and as we've gotten more acceptance on getting the games out, it's allowing us to go back and get some of the licenses we couldn't afford before.
Finally.
I mean, we've had some problems. Like, there's an unreleased Rocky and Bullwinkle game. And we went to them and said, hey, we'd like to release this. And they go, well, it'll be $10,000, please. You know, and it's like, well, gee, at the time, that was like, that's like our entire budget for doing a release or something. So we can probably go back and start getting some of these games out. But
well, that game probably still isn't worth $10,000.
Well, that game probably isn't worth $10,000. But there are some other games that probably are. And, of course, yeah. We'd love to get Burger Time. If we have real quick time.
Data East contact.
We have real quick time. I just want Ray to tell the story. I mean, Ray was all set. He was going to do Locomotion. That was the game that he was set to do, that Ray Kestner was going to do the Locomotion game, and he went on vacation, and tell what happened.
All right, so I'm on vacation in Alaska, and I'm kind of thinking about, well, Locomotion, how can I do it? I kind of had some plans in mind. I come back from vacation, and I find that Daniel Bass, one of the other programmers, he really liked the game of Locomotion. He played it a lot while I was gone, and he was also dreaming about Locomotion, so he put together a prototype while I was gone of Locomotion. It was really good. And so I come back and I go, but that's my game. What's going on here? What am I going to do? And so Gabriel took me into called me into his office very quietly, and he said, okay, we got a game for you. And I go, and so he said, it's going to be good. And he showed me the Burger Time video game, arcade game, and he said, this is the one we want you to do. And I go, oh, that was pretty good. And so Burger Time has been great for me because it was fun to do, it was fun to work on. It very successful, worked good for Mattel. But I wasn't supposed to do that game. I was supposed to do a different game. But I'm so glad that that's the game that I got to do, because it was way, just, it worked out so well.
And it worked out better for him than for any other programmer, because they did, right before the game came out, they did institute a royalty basis, a royalty program for games coming out, and that one...
Well, and the other thing that we were talking about yesterday was that Mattel was coming out with this home computer system called the Aquarius, and so they thought that was going to be the big thing. You know, it was going to compete with, I guess, the Timex Sinclair was kind of just fading at that point in time. And so they said, well, we can beat the Timex Sinclair. It's really an awful computer system. It was very poorly timed for the market.
The Aquarius was, because they brought, John and I went down and met with them, and they showed us this thing, and we said, no, that, you know, we told them the Chiclet keyboard was stupid and that they shouldn't do that, but they did anyway. But they were targeting it to compete with the VIC-10, which was...
VIC-20.
No. It was targeted to compete with the VIC-10, which was supposed to be coming out at the $100 price point. But by the time it came out, the VIC-20 was $100.
And the Commodore 64 was just about
to show. And the TI-99-4A, which was a much better machine, was $50 at Toys R Us. Of course, it was also discontinued. But basically, the price of the computers... The market shifted way faster. Right. They said we can have a computer that's like better than a Timex Sinclair at the Timex Sinclair price, and it'll compete with this VIC-10 that was supposed to come out that was like a stripped down VIC-20, except that by the time it got there, the price point was gone.
So Mattel, they had to plan for this to be the big thing, and so they bought up lots of commercial time for this next big thing. And so here they were caught with a product that they realized, fortunately they realized by then that it was going to be a dog. And so they canceled the product, but they had all this commercial time left. So Burger Time was the beneficiary of that, because all those Burger Time commercials you guys saw were not supposed to be Burger Time commercials. They were supposed to be for this computer that was bad. And so Burger Time got marketing dollars devoted to it. It was a good game. It deserved the marketing dollars, but... It really wasn't supposed to be that way, and so we benefited from it. Data East was a company that really didn't have any successful video games. So not only did we create the market for, you know, my game, but we also created the market for the arcade game that we were based on. And so it worked out good for all of us.
And it worked out good for me too, because I inherited the Data East product after I left Mattel, and ended up getting a deal to do 28 total conversions for Data East games over the next couple of years.
Yeah, but to completely answer the question, Keith is looking into creating newer versions of many of the classic Intellivision games, Astro Smash, Night Stalker. We've done some treatments of both of them and have yet to turn them into 3D prototypes. So we're trying to come up with PlayStation 2, Xbox competitive products that are based on the Intellivision original
and
games.
And also handheld. The handheld has sold a million.
Yeah, the handheld line, the Intellivision 25 and Intellivision 10, the little which I know a lot of the Intellivision purists say, well, these don't look like the original games. That is allowing us to do this other stuff. So it's allowing us to move forward and do more of the true emulation on the PlayStation and the Xbox and these other systems. So any of you who have seen the Intellivision 25 and Intellivision 10 are mad because it's not purely the original Intellivision game, because all of those systems, in case you don't know, ours, the Jack specific ones, all of they are the Nintendo chipset, the old NES chipset. And so the games are converted to the NES, all of them that you see. They're all ports over to NES. That's what you're getting with those. But that's the kids today, a new generation, are seeing these games, and they love them, and they don't know that they're not the 100% pure, that it doesn't have the particular sound effect from Astro Smash or whatever. And so we sold a million of those, and that's allowing us to move forward and to move the Intellivision brand further and to create some new games.
Cell phones, too.
And cell phones. We're on cell phones. And...
I don't know how that's going, but...
Cell phones are good. The only problem with cell phones is there's so many different types, it's difficult to know which one can download which version of which game. So we try to keep a chart on our website, but it's always out of date.
I want everybody to make sure you get another plug. If you don't already have some of the
some of the CDs that Keith's produced over the last couple of years. He's really
Keith, Bill, Dave, they've really
been the keepers of the flame on this stuff. And with a lot of the games that were not released during the first incarnation of Mattel Electronics, they've done an excellent job of preserving and then releasing PC versions of some of these unreleased games, and they really reflect, you know, everybody's innovation, you know, at a time when the average digital watch has more memory than some of these game cartridges. You really owe it to yourself to take a look at what they were able to do. It's easy to come up with an idea and say, hey, how about doing, I mean, I was guilty all the time, hey, how about if we do this? And I didn't know better to not say that, because most of the time it was impossible. But most of the time the answer was, well, you can't do that. Wait a minute. And they would do it. And all of those innovations are on those in-between games that these guys were able to release begin releasing
right
during that INTV period. So.
Yeah, the great thing about having the Intellivision and doing the Intellivision games is, unlike the other some of the other companies that are doing retro games, we're working with the original people. You know, Bill Fisher's company has done the Windows and Mac version. Steve wrote the Mac emulator that's been the basis of the Windows emulator that Quicksilver has done. Dave's company has done the PlayStation, the Xbox, and the GameCube version that will be coming out for Christmas. When THQ Wireless was doing Astro Smash for cell phones, the problem was, well, you don't want a cell phone to play a game for an hour. You want a cell phone to play a game for 5 or 10 minutes. So it's like, well, how are we going to convert Astro Smash? Well, it's not like, well, let's do this or that. They called up John Soule and used him as a consultant as what would you do to make the game a 5-10 minute game as opposed to an hour long game? So we have the original people involved at every stage of these games that we're doing under the Intellivision name. So it's not some anonymous company trying to cash in on the old stuff. It's the Blue Sky Rangers
trying to cash in.
Yes.
Boom.
Okay.
All right. I think we're out of time on that.
That's right. We are out of time. With that, thank you very much.